Well, Fire Arrow by Franklin Allen Leib. I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes.
It's being billed as a techno thriller. What is a techno thriller?
Well, I'm not sure this is a techno thriller. I think that's Tom Clancy's genre, and I think he does it better than anyone. But there is an emphasis, not an emphasis, but a utilization of modern military technology and specific technology as part and parcel of the characterization in the novel.
Well, I'll say there is, and but there's so much information about it. I could pick almost any page, and they talk about ROTC, I know. BTRs. Almost every page has got things. Cobras. NCOs. Well, NCO, I know what that is. ANGLICO. How do you pronounce that?
Anglico.
What's that mean?
That's an Air and Naval Gunfire Liaison Company. There is a footnote to that at some point in the book.
XO. What's an XO?
Executive Officer.
So you must have had a big military background and have retained all this information, is that right?
Well, I was in the Navy for 3.5 years in the 60s and 70s, actually in the 60s, entirely in the 60s. And I guess I've retained a fair amount of it, but I've also done a fair amount of research. This book, as you know, involves naval activities, but at the end of the day, it's basically an Army show.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to do a great deal of research about Army weapons and tactics, and indeed Soviet weapons and tactics, because I modeled the Libyan the Libyan forces are advised by Soviets, and I modeled their tactics on Russian tactics.
Well, tell me how Fire Arrow came about.
I wanted to write a book about terrorism because I think that it's a subject which has been, you know, not ignored certainly, but somewhat misused in popular fiction. And I wanted to write a book about an incident which was essentially so intractable that it would require strong governmental action. And I also wanted to put it in a context where the conventional wisdom, at least some of the expressed conventional wisdom, that what you do is you form some sort of a consensus and eventually these things get worked out, simply wouldn't function.
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, I think it's interesting in the present political campaign, you have one candidate saying that he advocates the use of military force when appropriate, and the other saying only as a last resort, only in conjunction with the Allies, etc. And here is a situation which gets to the point of last resort in only very few days. I mean, essentially, in order to achieve this, you needed the worst possible terrorist environment, and that would be a situation where the hostages were American, because it's somewhat easier to be dispassionate when they're Kuwaitis or somebody else. It'd have to be in a situation where there was no possibility of communicating with the terrorists, simply because there are no reliable avenues to communicate. And it would be where the terrorists are holding hostages in a territory which was hostile to the United States and indeed a Soviet client.
But the military operation was a failure. It saved the hostages, but 36 lives, American lives, were lost.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of realism that should be written in any book of this kind. One of the essential aspects of any military operation is that it never goes according to plan. People don't arrive where they're supposed to. The weapons may not be at the right place at the right time, or they may not function. Command and control breaks down, and the reality of military operations and the reality of leadership is how well the commanders, be they a sergeant commanding a tank platoon or the admiral running the whole show, is able to get back on track and get the best information he can and go ahead and fight the war. You would not be able to run this operation without taking casualties. It would be unrealistic even to attempt it.
The irony of it was the Soviets were about ready to do the job that our own military people did or tried to do.
Again, you're looking at what I think is a fairly realistic environment where you don't have perfect communications. The Soviet situation is sufficiently confused that probably no one in the Soviet government could have exactly predicted what that force would have done, and indeed they got their orders rather late. But then again, I think that maybe what I'm suggesting here is that there is a common interest among all civilized nations, regardless of their politics, to do something in concert against terrorism. It doesn't get done because of political conflict, but what I'm trying to suggest about Soviet behavior in this thing is that they certainly are acting responsibly as best they can, and they're not acting in concert with the terrorists.
Is the operation, an operation like this, worth it with all of those casualties? I mean, I think what you're saying is that the United States in this action had to make a point. Take the lid off first or you'll get a surprise. The United States had to make a point, and it did it at the risk of all of these fatalities.
Well, I think it's more than a point that has to be made. I mean, the reason that this is set up the way it is because this is something you can't look away from. These are not only U.S. personnel, but they're, for the most part, military dependents. You can't just sit idly by and have 65 people assassinated one at a time and do nothing about it, even if your casualties are going to be high.
This is reminiscent of, well, of course, the Israelis. I think you make reference to it. The Israelis had a very successful rescue of hostages. During the Carter administration, there was a disastrous one where the two helicopters collided in the desert in Iran. That was certainly bungled. This one, it looks like it was planned very well, and yet everything seemed to go wrong. Why? What happened?
Well, because things do go wrong. I mean, that's I think, one of the strengths of this book. You get these thrillers where everything seems to go according to plan, and with great daring do the people escape unscathed. Doesn't happen. I mean, you have an immediate problem on the landing. In front of the lead aircraft gets shot down. That increases the dispersion of the paratroopers on the ground. The Soviets have moved most of the Libyan defending armor from where it would have been very exposed in the original transformation. But these things happen. The commanding officer of the airborne ends up in the ocean. Whenever any military operation runs a battle problem, whether it's in Europe or any place else in training, the first thing that the referee does is walk up to the commanding officer and puts a red tag on his shoulder and says, "You're dead." It's the first thing they always do. And it's realistic.
If something like this were to happen next week, would you advocate a military attempt to rescue the hostages?
Given the reality as set forth in this book, where there's no communications really either with the Libyan government or with the terrorists, and where they are indeed executing hostages, I would see very little choice.
Even at the risk of all of these military casualties, and indeed the casualties of the hostages themselves.
Yeah, as I say, you have to have the situation as it is. If there was any possibility of dialogue, and indeed even if there was no dialogue but no shooting, then I would say that restraint was appropriate.
I guess there really isn't much chance for dialogue with those people, is there? And they are so angry and so hostile that they seem to act... Well, actually, they're suicidal in many respects, aren't they?
I think in some cases they are. I think the vast majority of terrorists that do hijackings are largely doing it because they want to get exposure in the media. And I think it's interesting that the last one that we had, which was the Kuwaiti airliner, essentially fell apart because, I don't remember what it was, but there was another event going on in the world which cost them all of their media. And they suddenly are looking out the windows of the airplanes and not seeing any press, so they just basically gave it up. This is a particularly rabid type of group. I mean, because you do have these people that have become so desperate where they simply can't achieve their aims that they do indeed become suicidal.
Well, the book certainly is timely. There's the trial of this terrorist over in Italy, right?
Yes, Hamidi.
And in fact, you dedicate the book to one of the Navy divers who was killed, Robert Stethem, and indeed testimony this week is going on about his murder. You must have felt pretty deeply about this, huh?
I did. I did at the time, and I still do.
To dedicate the book to him? Mm-hmm. And you never knew him, of course.
No.
Tell me a little bit about how you did the research for this. You were in the Navy when?
In 1966 until 1969.
So that was quite a while ago.
Yes,
so a lot of the details have left you, and probably there's a lot of new technology that has developed since then too. So, how did you embark upon the research for Fire Arrow?
There are a lot of U.S. Army publications which are available in libraries and available from the Army. These are all, of course, unclassified. There is something called a country study, which is available for just about any country in the world. I took the one on Libya. That gives you things like the disposition of their forces and equipment. It also gives you information about what the climate is like, what crops they grow, what their religion is, what their political practices are. It gives you a lot of biographical information on their leadership. I read a technical manual for the Sheridan fighting vehicle, which is the American light tank that's in this. I read a technical manual on the various Soviet weapons. These are both U.S. Army publications. Books like Jane's Fighting Ships, Jane's All the World's Aircraft. There's even a Grove Press book about the U.S. military establishment, which gives great detail. And, again, books on Soviet weapons and tactics and on Sheridan tactics. And after I'd finished the book, and indeed after I'd sold it, I took a trip down to Fort Bragg and spent 3 days with the 82nd Airborne Division, which includes this third of the 73rd Armor Unit, and went around with them and saw all phases of the operation, from riding around on the tank, from seeing how the tanks are deployed, from seeing how they're rigged for drop, and was able to talk to the people who actually did all the work, and then took a ride with the airborne and watched him jump. And that resulted, after I came back from that trip, I rewrote largely for color some sections and did indeed make some corrections of tactical errors I'd made with the airborne operation.
Did you have any military advisors reading the copy after you finished?
I have a friend who is in the Army Reserve who read the thing both during and afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Fire Arrow has kind of an interesting story about how the book came to be published. Tell me about that.
Well, I'd sent it out to a number of publishers without much success, or without any success.
With an agent?
No, without an agent, because I was really not having any greater success in getting agents interested than I was in getting publishers interested. There is a problem with people that have never been published. It's a bit of a catch-22. And I eventually retained an agent who's out in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee. I didn't know they had agents out in Milwaukee.
Well, they do.
How did you find this agent?
Well, there's a publication called Writer's Market, and agents list themselves, and they put a little squib in there about what they think they do well. And I wrote to about a dozen, and that waited to see what came back from that, and there were several queries which people were quite interested. And this fellow was one of them, and I talked to him, and he said he was a young guy, and he had not been terribly successful, but that he liked the book very much, and he thought he could place it, and that he would work very hard on it. And that was very encouraging to me, because I really, having gotten a little bit of a taste of the agent situation in New York, it was clear to me that the very prominent ones have very high-profile clients, and if they can make two phone calls and sell a book, they're not going to really be able to, or probably not going to be inclined to devote the kind of energy that you would have to devote to sell somebody who's unknown. And he sent it to Presidio Press in California, and they liked it and made an offer on it immediately, and indeed asked to see the manuscript of my second novel, which they also bought.
What kind of publisher is Presidio? I'm not familiar with it.
They have made their reputation to date as publishers of scholarly military history, and they have been into fiction of a military nature for, I would guess, 2 years now. And they had a success with a book called Team Yankee, which was about a tank operation in Europe. And they have done a few others. They've probably done maybe three now, up to the time of this one. And they like the idea of doing it. They think they bring an expertise to the table, which I believe they do, because the publisher is a former artillery colonel, and several of the people on the staff are from various military branches. And they feel they can look at these books with a practiced eye. You asked earlier about techno thrillers. I think the real thing that they bring to the table, and something which I think is very important because it absolutely stops me when I read a book, is accuracy. It's not so much that the gear is going to war the way it does in what I would consider a true techno thriller. The gear really doesn't begin the gear. Like the tanks, the airplanes, the submarines, whatever. It's the people that are going to war, but they have to go to war. They have to do it in a certain way. I mean, you'd expect them to take along their weapons, and you'd expect them to be able to use the tactics that they've established. So it's a question of accuracy more than anything else that I think is why you have the detail that you do have.
Well, Tom Clancy also paved the way, didn't he? He started not much differently than you did with a small, I think it was called the Naval Institute Press.
Yes, it was.
He started small, but that book really took off. And so there became a lot of interest in these military fillers. So I think this is a nice way for you to cash in, isn't
well,
it?
I certainly would hope for some similar success as Tom Clancy has had. It's a very good company to be in. I've just finished his most recent book.
Mm-hmm. Is there a paperback in the works?
Yes, the paperbound will be out next year. It's coming from Ivy.
Mm-hmm. So you have a multi-book contract?
Yes, three books.
Three books. Tell me a little bit about you. This is your first book. But you haven't lived in a vacuum. You must have been doing something else since you got out of the Navy.
When I first got out of the Navy, I went to business school, and then I went to work for Bankers Trust Company and was in the international department for 12 years in a number of different positions, probably the most interesting of which was I set up and ran a merchant bank in Hong Kong.
Are you with Bankers Trust now?
No, I'm not. I left Bankers Trust in 1983 to set up my own consulting business, which I still run.
And what do you consult?
I'm a financial consultant, and nine-tenths of what I do is putting people together with banks to borrow money.
What has been the reaction of your clients and colleagues to your literary efforts?
Well, they've been very supportive, and they're very happy with it, and they like the book.
Tell me about your next one. You're working on a book now. What's that going to be about? More terrorists? More military operations?
It's a book about Vietnam, and it's a book which basically follows four characters from their earliest induction to the armed forces through a period of being in Vietnam, or a couple of periods in some cases. And it's more of a novel than it is a thriller. It tries to show not only what Vietnam was like, but what the home front was like for the people who were involved during that period. And it's complete. It'll be out next year too.
Is your writing cutting into your consulting business?
Well, it's going to begin to. It was basically I was writing at night, but now I'm writing during the day and spending less time on the business.
Well, I think readers are going to enjoy this this thriller. Oh, by the way, I wanted to ask you, are you taking sides in the election? I know the Republicans during the Reagan administration were relatively aggressive, bombing Gaddafi, for example, and invading little places like Grenada. You support things like that?
Not without reservations. I certainly think that the world is a safer place when the United States is viewed as being firmly resolved to take what action is necessary when necessary. I think that if you have a president who's perceived to be unwilling or unable to use force when it's needed, and only when it's needed, then you tend to tempt not only the Soviet Union, but also smaller states to be adventurous.
But what about warring on countries without a declaration of war and support the advice and consent of Congress? I mean, how can a president just unilaterally invade a country?
Well, I
it's not even legal. I mean, there was an effort, a very feeble effort, because Reagan had so much popularity, to impeach him for this action, because there was a feeling that he acted unconstitutionally. But he's so popular that it just fizzled.
Well, I'm not sure that it is illegal. It's a police action.
To invade a country and take it over with troops?
Well, when there's a provocation to do so, and what the argument was made that the Cubans said had already invaded the country and that the Cubans were taking armed action against was a group of students, wasn't it?
What was it, a group of students?
Wasn't there a group of students in a medical school on
Grenada? It was a medical school, yeah. There was some...
There were allegations
that they were being threatened, but there was no proof.
Well, I think the only thing you can say, and again, you can...
Reagan bombed Libya, and he said that they were responsible for, I think, blowing up a nightclub in West Germany, but he didn't offer any proof. I mean, he just did it. I mean, he was itching to bomb Gaddafi. He wanted to. And I don't doubt that Gaddafi needed bombing.
Well, of course, again, there are always going to be different sides of the story. I do know one thing, because I discussed the grenade operation in great detail with the people down the 82nd Airborne, who did most of it. And they found really an awful lot of weapons and ammunition on that island, much more than they expected, much more indeed than they were prepared to have to deal with. But this certainly was no simple construction crew that was down there on that island from Cuba.
Well, we did all right. We only lost one life. Of course, it wasn't much resistance.
Well, there was quite a bit of resistance.
Was there?
Yeah, there's a very good film, actually, that they made down there called Urgent Fury, which was the name of the operation. And one of the complaints, and it's in this book, actually, where it's represented that the armor was left behind because they didn't think there'd be a need for them.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there weren't supposed to be any Russian-built armor on Grenada. Well, there were. Light armor, but nonetheless armor, some of these very BMPs and BTRs you read about. And they would have been very useful in that operation, and they literally have not forgiven the planners for not taking them along.
Well, I've talked to Tom Clancy a couple of times. He's a big supporter of Reagan and of military action throughout the world, where he thinks that the commander-in-chief deems it necessary. But in a democratic country, that's a little hard to swallow. It seems to me that the people have not given the president carte blanche to declare war, and that this is a very, very important thing that the whole country should have some part in, and at least through our elected representatives, don't you think?
I think I would agree with you, were it not for the fact that the elected branch of the government, the legislative branch of the government, has shown itself really to be unable to act swiftly, not only in cases of this kind.
What happens in a democracy?
Well, but you know, what would you do? Would you just have the Congress debate while these people are one by one executed?
This is not quite the same thing. When you're talking about an effort to rescue the hostages, I wouldn't disagree with that. In fact, I would have supported that effort that during the Carter administration that was so bungled. It would have been a wonderful thing. In fact, there's this wonderful story, and I can't remember who wrote this. This was the one of H. Ross Perot had organized a group to rescue hostages, his own men, in Tehran. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
And it was written, it was made into a wonderful thriller, the author of which, written a lot of them, I've interviewed, I can't think of his name. But this was a wonderful thing. You felt good because you knew that these people were acting so irrationally. And you felt good that we could actually, nobody else would do anything. And so we actually did it. We went in and rescued these people. You felt good at Entebbe when the Israelis rescued these people. But to invade a country without much provocation, I mean, that's a little different, though, isn't it?
Well, I don't really recall in great detail the political antecedents of that. But, I mean, the result was, I think, a good one. I think the Grenadians benefited. Whether there was adequate provocation, you could argue about.
Well, there was a philosophic viewpoint at the time where people said, well, we lost the Vietnam War and we had to go out and win a war. So
well,
we invaded Grenada.
There may be an undercurrent of that, and I think that's something that perhaps should be examined. But if you believe there was adequate reason for the thing to go forward, it should go forward. And I'd like to make one other point just back to you on this thing about the legislative branch. The only reason the Grenada operation worked as well as it did, and there were a lot of problems with it, was because they didn't tell anybody. And you can't tell the United States Congress about something like this without it being in the paper within minutes. And you need secrecy to run an operation like that. And the way that they actually did it, as I understand it, is they just put the lads on the airplane, and the first thing that the troops had any reason to believe was ending up in a training exercise when they started loading the live ammunition. And that's how they ran that operation. And the Marine Corps contingent of that operation was theoretically on its way to Lebanon, and it was just diverted while at sea. And that only because they were able to keep it down to about four or five people in the government who knew the timing and the plan for the operation was it able to be a success.
Yeah, and they kept the press off of it, too. I mean,
that's
really
right.
Kept it. They didn't allow any combat photographers or anything.
Yeah, they got two people or something?
I don't know. Well, they may have had someone there, but they were restricted.
Oh, they were restricted.
Kept away from the island and this sort of thing. I don't know. I'm not particularly happy about that. Well, we won it. So we can throw our hats up in the air and cheer. We beat the Grenadians. Well, I think Fire and Arrow is a fast read, and people are going to like it. Franklin Allen Leib, thank you very much.
Thank you.